Professor Sachs, so nice to have you back on this podcast.
Great to be back with you. Thank you.
And let's get started with Anthony Blinken's visit together with Lamy to Kiev. Do we know what they're seeking for and what would be the official policy of the United States right now considering the conflict in Ukraine?
Well, I don't know what they're discussing internally, but the situation is bad, and Blinken is on his way out, of course. This is the end of his period. It's the end of the Biden administration. We don't know what will come next. It seems to be pretty much 50-50 between Trump and Harris. Whoever wins, Blinken won't be there. And even with Harris, there could be some change of policy. With Trump, there would be a decisive change of policy. So I don't think that Blinken can do too much except this one issue that obviously is being discussed, and that is the approval for Ukraine to use NATO weapons to reach deep inside Russia. This, by rumor, seems to be in the process of being approved. The British, of course, want it. The British want anything that escalates any war, anytime, anywhere. The United States seems to be giving in. To my mind, it's another step of reckless escalation by the US and UK. But this perhaps is the topic of the discussion.
You consider a significant difference between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump considering the conflict in Ukraine. Can we understand what would that be considering the latest debate that they had?
Yes, basically, Harris is a continuation of the U.S. deep state, and she said it, and every word she said is yes. We stand up for continued war. We stand up, she didn't say it this way, but for continued slaughter of Ukrainians. We stand up for continued escalation. In other words, she stands up for what has been U.S. policy for 30 years, which has been confrontational vis-a-vis Russia, expand NATO, put Ukraine in the front line to die on behalf of NATO, to weaken Russia. All of that is what she said. Whether she understands anything, I don't know. But she obviously is the mouthpiece of the U.S. deep state. Trump said he would end the war. He and certainly his vice president as well, vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance, know that this is a losing proposition, that this war should stop. I think Trump would stop it. You know, what he would do in other areas, I'm not so sure or clear about. But when it comes to Ukraine, I don't think Trump sees this issue, which the deep state views as crucial, which is confronting Russia and expanding NATO, as in America's interest. And so on this, I think Trump is absolutely right, and that there's a clear difference between Trump and Harris.
It seems that Zelensky is talking about a victory plan. And on the other hand, they're asking for more ammunition. They want to strike deeper in the Russian territory right now. The British government is totally in with this plan. And how about the United States? Do they really, at the end of the day, permit Zelensky to do that?
Well, look, there is no victory. There's only the possibility of escalation to World War III. That's the only issue. What does victory mean? That Ukraine is going to defeat Russia? The whole idea is absurd. What can happen is escalation by the U.S. With cheerleading by the U.K., and then escalation by Russia, and then escalation by the U.S. until we have a full-fledged nuclear war. That's what they call victory. It's so foolish, so irresponsible, so lame, this language. they don't have, obviously, a plan for victory. We heard, you know, the people who really run the show, basically the CIA and MI6 on display with the CIA Director Burns telling us, don't worry about nuclear war. That's just a bluff. That's, well, you better say it now before the world ends, because you won't have a chance to say it afterwards. I never want to hear a senior U.S. official say such absolute, irresponsible, reckless things as this, because that's what it is. And Burns knows better, absolutely. And Burns is the author of the long memo in 2008, which explained this war clearly, when he explained that the Russian political class completely opposes NATO in Ukraine. And he explained why. And he explained how the Russians feared in 2008, not only that NATO would be so reckless, but that it would probably lead to civil war inside Ukraine. He laid it all out. Now he's CIA director. Now we don't ever expect to hear truth from CIA directors. But what he's telling us, don't worry about nuclear war. Well, I completely, totally, utterly reject this and refer everybody back to Burns's 2008 memo. Let everybody read it. It's online. They can see why we have this war. They can see that the CIA director knows why we have this war, and they can see why there's no such thing as victory in this war. There's only global disaster or NATO saying we won't expand to Ukraine. We'll find another way for peace, which is so obvious and was achievable all along. And so all of this talk about victory is, I can't use the word on air because it's an expletive, but that's what it is. And they don't explain anything to the public, but there is no concept of victory and no possibility of victory. There is only the possibility of escalation or peace. And so that this is what it's about. Blinken has been a disaster. Of course, I don't know what his role is. The CIA has been a disaster in this. Biden is nowhere to be seen anymore. Not only a lame duck, but possibly not really functional very much. So this is where we are. It's not good.
The United States was in Afghanistan for more than 20 years. And at the end of the day, they left Afghanistan in that situation that we've witnessed. But right now, it seems in Ukraine, we are witnessing the far-right ultra-nationalists are totally in charge of the government in Kiev. It doesn't seem that Zelensky have any sort of power when it comes to what's going on in Ukraine. Do you think right now the Biden administration, considering, do they have any sort of leverage on these people?
Well, let me say, by the way, about Afghanistan, that what I said to Ukrainians before all of this was, if you continue the way the U.S. is pushing, you will be the Afghanistan of Europe. And this is exactly what's happening. And it is true that the staying power of the U.S. to destroy a place utterly and totally is there. So the U.S. could continue for years on end to fund the destruction of Ukraine. Of course, that's not how it's portrayed, but that's what it is. We're going to see all the cities destroyed. We're going to see a whole generation of Ukrainians killed. And then some president will come and say, well, that's not really in America's interest, so we end it. And then one day the helicopters will leave and people will be running from the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. This is so typical of the United States. I've seen it all my life, this kind of U.S. foreign policy failure. It was completely clear for 30 years that pushing NATO to Ukraine was a disastrous idea, and that any intelligent Ukrainian would know that it's not in Ukraine's national interest. And the last one that was in charge that knew it was Yanukovych. So the U.S. overthrew him in February 2014, and that's when the war started. Now, Biden, okay, he's gone, maybe now already, in effect, I don't know. We don't see any much of him anymore. But he's gone as of January 20, 2025. And the question is whether the next one that comes in just continues what has now been a policy, by the way, established 30 years ago this year, because it was established in 1994 by Bill Clinton, that NATO would expand and it would expand to Ukraine. We now know this from historians who are digging through files, archives, memoirs, their discussions, that this, I thought it went back to Brzezinski in 1997, but it apparently goes back to decisions by the Clinton administration in 1994.
Yeah. And here is what Lloyd Austin was talking about, the official position of Ukrainian government right now, asking for more ammunition, for more weapons.
Well, thanks, Phil. I did get a chance to spend some quality time with President Zelensky. And you'll recall that President Zelensky outlined his goals and objectives during his opening comments. And I would point you to that to if you have questions about specific objectives. But in terms of the plan for victory, Phil, we didn't discuss that. We talked about a number of things, but that specific piece we didn't discuss. And President Zelensky is going to present that to President Biden and other leaders, at the first opportunity. In terms of whether or not victory is achievable, again, I think this war could end very quickly if Mr. Putin decided to pull his forces out of the places that he's occupied in Ukraine. I mean, this was started by Putin. It could end. Putin could end it very quickly if he just made the simple and right decision to undo what he's done. In terms of absolute victory, it really depends on how you define that. Ukraine is focused on defending its sovereign territory. We're going to continue to do everything we can to help them do that. What Russia's goals and objectives are, I could speak to that specifically, and victory would be defined by goals and objectives. But we know from the very beginning that he's wanted to annex Ukraine because he doesn't believe that Ukraine is a bona fide country. I think that eventually this conflict will be decided at a resolved at a negotiation table.
Completely incoherent, by the way. The idea that that Putin from the beginning wanted to annex Ukraine is doesn't even reach the dignity of a talking point. It's a joke. It's an absurdity. It's if you're talking to people who know nothing, or you don't care whether what you say has any respectability at all. Is he serious? No, of course not, because this has not been Russia's objective. Russia's objective was NATO should not expand to Ukraine. The U.S. should not overthrow governments in Kiev. And the U.S. should absolutely stop sending Ukrainians to their death, and instead honor the Minsk agreements. During the whole 2010s, or from 2015 onward, there was a negotiated peace, except the United States and Ukraine rejected it, even though Ukraine had signed it and the UN Security Council had supported it. The Minsk II agreements. Was that for annexation? No. Come on, Mr. Secretary, tell the truth. The truth was that the United States absolutely told the Ukrainians, you don't have to follow through on an agreement you've signed because you can have it all. We'll arm you. You'll be part of NATO. All the fairy tales. And so when you hear the defense secretary saying that the goal was annexation, it's not even propaganda because it doesn't even come close to no scintilla of truth at all to this. This is why it's so sad, because without responsibility, wars can go on forever. What I'm told by people who know is that a lot of people are making money on this. A lot of former Pentagon senior officials are now in the military contractors. For them, longer war is better war. This is, this is big business, big military contracts. I'm not part of that world. I don't know whether that's really the motivation or whether the motivation is power, whether the motivation is the U.S. has to be able to have its say anywhere in the world. It's a little hard to know whether this is about power or just greed of military contractors, but it's certainly not about peace and it's not about Ukraine, because Ukraine is losing terribly in this.
The other point he was talking about is to withdraw all the troops from the eastern part of Ukraine, the Russian troops. And after more than 2 years in this conflict, 700,000 Ukrainians were killed and more than 100 Russian soldiers as well. And he's talking about withdrawing the troops from the eastern part, just pretending that nothing happened. How he can come with this conclusion to put an end to this conflict, in your opinion? And why he's suggesting that right now?
There have not been negotiations between the U.S. and Russia, basically, I would say, incidentally, for 30 years. The U.S. attitude is, we say and you do. And that is the attitude that the U.S. held when the Soviet Union ended and Russia became an independent successor state or continuation state, according to international law. And the U.S. said, we can act with impunity and you fall into line. So there have not been real negotiations over anything. And President Putin repeatedly called for bilateral negotiations, a U.S.-Russia security agreement. He put it on the table on December 15th, 2021. The U.S. rejected negotiating over it because it said stop NATO enlargement. This is the opposite of what the U.S. deep state wants. They say what they want. They don't get the results that they want. Ukrainians die in massive numbers. This Ukrainian regime was brought in for this purpose, and purpose is to fight on behalf of the United States against Russia. Lloyd Austin's the one that said that our goal is to weaken this already years ago, this is really about weakening Russia. That's our goal. Well, it's a miserable goal. It doesn't work. And it sacrifices Ukraine in the process.
Victoria Nuland, in her recent interview, she was talking about why they have decided not to negotiate with Russia in 2022. And here is what she said.
First told by former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett that both sides were really close to the end, to the successful end of the negotiations. And then Prime Minister Boris Johnson interfered and stopped Ukrainians from signing the deal. And then Ukrainian representative Arahami kind of confirmed it, that yes, he said in an interview that there was some kind of advice from Boris Johnson to stop negotiating and to win this war militarily. Where is the myth? Where is the truth?
Relatively late in the game, the Ukrainians began asking for advice on where this thing was going. And it became clear to us, clear to the Brits, clear to others, that Putin's main condition was buried in an annex to this document that they were working on. Mm-hmm. And it included limits on the precise kinds of weapon systems that Ukraine could have after the deal, such that Ukraine would basically be neutered as a military force. And there were no similar constraints on Russia. Russia wasn't required to pull back. Russia wasn't required to have a buffer zone from the Ukrainian border, wasn't required to have the same constraints on its military facing Ukraine. And so people inside Ukraine and people outside Ukraine started asking questions about whether this was a good deal. And it was at that point that it fell apart.
Yeah, that it fell apart.
Yeah, so the U.S. And Britain stopped the agreement. But what they didn't do, and Britain is a cheerleader for war with little role in this. It had a big role in 1853 in the Crimean War. Britain is now just a cheerleader for Western hegemony. It's not really an actor in it. It's falling apart internally because it can't keep the National Health Service running, can't keep the budget running, and so forth. But it cheerleads for war like it has always done. And it's not coincidence, because this is the Anglo-American world, that it's MI6 and CIA together, that it's Lamy and Blinken together. It's absurd. But anyway, so Britain's there rhetorically. But this is about the U.S. But you see, Nuland, well, it's just, I, again, lose the words in polite company. But Nuland has no awareness of responsibility at all. Late in the day, the agreement was stopped. Well, where was the U.S. negotiating with Russia? Because this is what this is about. This is about the U.S. and Russia, in which Ukraine is dying in the middle. This is a war between the U.S. and Russia. It's not only a proxy war, it's a direct war, because there are plenty of Americans that are directly engaged in the war. It's extraordinarily dangerous. Nuland shows and never had any responsibility. She had formal, I mean, she had power, but she had never a sense of responsibility to Ukraine or to peace. Because if you're late in the day on negotiations and you're arguing about something in an annex, you close a deal. You finish the deal. You don't then say, no, they leave, stop the negotiations, and we'll have another 600,000 dead, which is exactly what she did and her accomplices did in the United States, condemning Ukraine to probably another 600,000 dead or so from that moment onward. Because of technical details about weapon systems in an annex, that's why. Well, I went to Ankara to talk to the Turkish mediators, and they said that one day the Ukrainians gave a note, we're done negotiating. They didn't say, well, we're working on this annex. They said, we're done negotiating. That's the U.S. deep state at work. Nuland was part of it. Again, I just hesitate because I have the words, but I can't share them in polite company.
The most important country in the European Union is Germany. Is the engine of the help that goes to Ukraine from the European Union. Is this engine running out of gas, considering the latest changes, AfD and far left, both of them are against the conflict in Ukraine?
Chancellor Scholz is one of the most unpopular political leaders in the world today. He has an approval rating of about 20%. The coalition that he leads basically collapsed in the two recent state elections, and there are more Länder elections to come. The German people know that this is Germany at the service of the U.S. This is not Germany for Europe or for German national interests, which would be to end this war, which would be to continue economic relations with Russia. It was not in Germany's interests that the U.S. blew up Nord Stream. So this is, Scholz has been basically a full accomplice of the U.S. war agenda from the start. This is not the typical case, by the way, of German chancellors, because you go back a long time to Willy Brandt, to Schmidt, to Kohl, to Schroeder, to Merkel. They all had some personality. They all told the U.S. no, there are limits. They told the U.S. no, Iraq is not a good idea. Merkel told Bush no. A roadmap to Ukraine's membership of NATO is not a good idea. Yes, we want to have a pipeline. They used to have a personality. They used to represent Germany. Scholz is the least of all of these in terms of standing up for Europe's interests and Germany's interests. And so it's been extraordinarily disappointing. And the German people are fed up with it because the economy has suffered terribly, because the dangers to Germany in the front line of a World War III are palpable, because what Scholz says and his defense minister and the generals say makes no sense. People know it. They're parroting the U.S. line. That's why Sarah Wagenknecht is making such a strong showing together with AfD, one on the so-called right and left, but it doesn't really matter. They're both, in this sense, they're both for peace, and they're both for a completely different approach. And the public is saying, yes, obviously, what's happening right now makes no sense. Now Scholz is, okay, he started to say something about negotiations. Well, come on, stand up as a chancellor of Germany, as previous chancellors have stood up, and express what is in Germany's and Europe's interest, which is for this war to end, and it does not need to have escalation on behalf of the U.S. putting its military bases in Ukraine. This is the bottom line, but it's been the story of this whole business for 30 years now. And they know it. And they know it because the Germans used to say to the Americans, at least in private, don't provoke this. But Scholz doesn't even say this now.
It's the economy, just to wrap up this session, is the economy of the European Union right now, with the situation that they're in right now, going to help all of us all around the world, and would be the solution to the conflict in Ukraine? Because when the economy is not doing great, that's why the countries would change their mind toward the conflict in Ukraine. Would that be the case in this conflict?
Europe needs a completely different kind of policy. By the way, the Draghi report has some very good ideas, but you can't do the Draghi report in the middle of war. You can't do an industrial policy and the development of a green digital future for Europe in the middle of a war. Instead, what you're seeing is Volkswagen shutting down plants and the German heavy industry shutting down and losing its competitiveness. That spreads, by the way, everywhere, because German industry was a bulwark for industry across Europe. And so everybody feels that pain. And to say, well, we're going to not have economic relations with Russia and think that Europe is going to somehow benefit for that, or even more stupidly, to follow the U.S. line on China and try to decouple trade with China, which is fundamentally important for the European economy, raises the question, is Brussels working for the United States or is it working for Europe? Is Chancellor Scholz working for Germany and Europe, or is it working, or is he working for the United States? These are the questions right now. But for Europe, Europe needs peace. It needs a diplomatic settlement. Europe was never in favor of NATO enlargement to Ukraine when it was proposed in 2008. It tried to resist the U.S. It didn't succeed. It then watched Europe slide into this war. It didn't raise its voice. This day, it has been silent because the U.S. has dictated the terms, but it's not in Europe's interest.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always, Professor
Sack. Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.